Hi guys, welcome back to the podcast, Overmatch Podcast. Caffeine and questions number 9. So I put a thing out on social media yesterday and I was like, what the F am I going to talk about now? And I got some really good questions and really good topics. And some of them are like way too in-depth for this platform. I'll try to answer some of them really, really quickly. But some of them need a little more attention and a little more detail. So we'll bang through them. I'm going to bounce around here and it's kind of going to jump around, you know, a lot. And it's not all going to be gun stuff, thank goodness. If you're watching this on YouTube, go ahead and subscribe, man. Come on, man. Don't be a... Anyway, like half the people who watch this video on YouTube are subscribed and it really does help. All right, so for those of you tracking, because like the third question I have here says, when will there be a Fieldcraft course in Oregon? I don't work for Fieldcraft, man. Come on, get with the times. I left Fieldcraft. And there's about a dozen questions about why I left Fieldcraft. I don't work for Fieldcraft. I have no interaction with them at all. All right, so I moved and it started at my own thing that I kind of was wanting to see where it would go and still kind of do that. But I want to do stuff that nobody else does. And long-range shooting is one, and that's been quite popular. Training, private training, training over Zoom, training people in ballistics. There's my dog barking. Not Vinny, another dog. Training people over Zoom on ballistics, on Kestrel and stuff like that has been really, really popular too. And I ran a course like 2 weeks ago in North Carolina, 12 students. Really, really cool. I had two kids there shooting 5.56 guns, pinging targets at 900 meters and understanding the ballistics behind it. So again, not a lot of this stuff doesn't need to be overcomplicated. It just needs to be explained properly. Question about land nav, doing it here. I haven't broken into the land nav market yet because I have to buy maps and compasses and figure out a classroom, and it's kind of a lot of overhead. If I thought there was a market there, I would, but I'm not convinced there is. But I kind of like teaching land nav, and I might branch into that. All right, let's bounce through some questions here in no particular order. Should I trade my guitar for a long-range rifle and handgun? Hell yeah. Come on, man. Get with the times. What makes a good leader? That's a really good question. I did a podcast with Oisin, who's a doctor, talking about leader and personality. I think empathy makes a good leader. I think looking at things from the subordinate's point of view makes you better. Now, that doesn't mean you have to be a pushover, but kind of seeing things from their side helps you maneuver them into getting the job done. And I think that's a good trait. Preferred long gun. Is that so many of these questions, the answer is, well, it depends. And I hate that answer because it's a bit of a cop-out, but it depends. You talking about the preferred one I'd like to have or the one I have? The preferred long gun I have a 300 Win Mag, and I really like that gun. I won in a match, but I'd love to have a Barrett MRAD. But just because I was involved in the development of it, of not the MRAD, but the ASR, but that's never going to happen because I can't afford it. So if I had my choice, I'd have a Barrett MRAD and I'd have a 300 Norma, I'd have a 300 Win Mag, I'd have a 6.5 Creedmoor barrel and a 308 barrel on it, and give me a lot of options. I am trying to upgrade my equipment now because since I'm out at the Hack Creek and since I was working with the Marine Corps, I was like, my shit's getting old. So I took my 300 Win Mag, I put an arc rail on the bottom of it, I bought a new bipod that I can run along the rail. I bought a new level, send it level, it's got the lights on, it's actually really cool. So I'm trying to upgrade. I bought a really right stuff tripod, got a new rangefinder. I'm trying to upgrade my gear, but I try not to go with anything too crazy or exotic because I kind of want to keep in the same realm as the people who are coming to me for training, right? You know, people talk about six millimeter arc and all this, and great, but people who are running six arc are generally not coming to me for training. They probably know enough about what they're doing. They probably shoot PRS. So I'm trying to keep, you know, when I go to training, if I want to run a demo, it's 5.56, 308, 6.5, 300 Win Mag. Like it's in that kind of family because that's what my customers are running. Is a 7.5 inch AR too short? It depends on what you want it for, right? That's a really short gun. Look, a lot of studies done. You're losing so much muzzle velocity to that short barrel. And the flame at the end of that thing is probably freaking huge. A lot of studies have been done. And if you want a short barrel, anything below 11.5 is really, really hurting your muzzle velocity. But if you're shooting at close range, who cares? So it depends, again, horrible answer, but it depends on your application. Yep, 7.5 inch AR, super cool, you run it in the house, but if you have to reach out at distance, it really is hurting you. Glock or SIG, both great companies, both great guns. I've carried a Glock for years and years and years because that's what we had in the Army. And there's a question later on about the M9 Beretta, carried that for years too, but I shot competitively for a long time with a Glock 34, and so I carried a SIG in Ireland, not personally, but the range wing in Ireland had SIG 226s. That's what we had. That's what I kind of learned how to shoot with. So I have history of both. When I got into SF, and I was in Germany for a couple of years, came back, got into SF, and got my carry permit. I wanted to carry a gun. I wanted to carry the same gun I had at work. And because I was in the SIF company, I had a Glock 19, is what we had. So I bought a Glock 19. It's nothing fancy, factory sights, freaking no red dot, nothing. And that's what I've been carrying for years and years and years, and I'm very, very comfortable with it. However, SIG's a great gun. I just got this. I just got an upper for a SIG, and the lower is a SIG 320 Legion, but the upper is a SIG Sims upper, and that's for some upcoming training that we're going to be doing. SIG or Glock? If I had to pick, I'd probably say Glock, just because I have so much history with it. SIG's a great company, make great products. What foreign soft units have you worked and trained with? I haven't worked with many, honestly, in combat, and it just didn't work out for me. But I've trained with a lot. In Ireland, I actually trained with the Germans and the French and stuff like that. And that whole relationship was starting to build just as I was leaving. But in the American military, I think, when I was in Kosovo, we sent, they came to us one time and they said, the Russians, we're going to do this relationship trade with the Russian military, right? They're going to send a squad here to our base, and a BTR-60, I think it was an armored vehicle, and a squad of Russians would come to us for a week. And we're going to send a squad and a Bradley fighting vehicle to the Russians for a week. And they're like, do you want to go? And I was like, no, I don't think so. I was like, something told me, red flag. Nope, I don't want to do that. So the Russians came to us, and we sent another squad leader and a squad over there. And the Russians came to us for a week, and they ate every piece of food we had. They ate us out of house and home. They were loving life. Well, it turns out the guys who went to the Russian sector starved. Fucking fat Americans, man. They wanted some chow, and they were not getting it. And then the Russians wanted to trade everything. They loved the Gerbers, and I mean they were good guys. We shot their guns. We went on patrol with them, but the guys who went to the Russian sector were like, it was awful. Yep, a little bit of hardship for you there, brother. After that, like, I was in Germany for 4 years, so we did some stuff with the Germans, not that much. Then let me think. I have been in a lot of Middle Eastern countries and trained and worked with a lot of Middle Eastern, like Jordan, UAE, Kuwait, Oman. I went to Oman for a couple of weeks. Actually, a really cool place. And I trained, me and my captain trained the Oman SAS Officer Corps on mission planning and VBSS, which is retaking ships. And they were really interested in lessons learned from combat. So I give a brief about lessons learned. My captain had been in Ranger Regiment before he came to SF, and he gave a brief about missions in Afghanistan. And I got to say, really professional soldiers. Like, we went in there, and big kind of classroom, was almost like a dining facility, big chandelier. They were all there in their dress uniforms, sitting up straight, very disciplined, very, very British Army structure, and that because of the British involvement in Oman for years and years and years. And you'll see that in Pakistan and India and all these places where the British Army were in there. But I trained with those guys, did a training, I think I talked about this on the podcast once, did a training mission with the Jordanian SOF. And Jordanian SOF has some really good guys, but the guys that were with us were not good. And we were doing a training mission where we were doing a free fall operation, jumping in and setting up a hide and or a couple of hides, and overwatching a target, and then the assault force come in and hit the target, right? Standard stuff. And they were like, yeah, these guys are going to jump with you. And I'm like, no, they're not. No, I'm the jump master. I'm telling you, they're not. You can do a second pass if you want, and they can jump. I don't know who these guys are. I'm not having them in the air with my guys. Not going to happen, right? So we jumped in, and they ground infilled. We split up into two groups. I had razors, the kind of ATV things, and we moved those up onto the top of the mountain, and we set up a hide up there with nets and all that, and we were watching the target. It was a village, And then my other part of my team are in the village in an urban hide. And urban hides are great because you've a roof over your head. But it can get close, right? So you have to be very, very quiet. You have to have escape routes, it's a whole thing, right? So the guys that were in the village, at one point were watching and a car pulled up outside their house. And a guy got out with a tray with chai, right? Tea and the glasses. And he went up and I contacted one of my guys and I'm like, what the hell is going on there? And he's like, this guy called his buddy and his buddy brought over tea to the house, right? I was giving him like, oh God, these guys got no tactical sense. And then again, in the house, in the middle of the night, one of them had night terrors and woke up screaming in a hide site that's 50 feet from the objective. The guys were with me up on the hill. They ate every piece of chow we had. The guy stole my sunglasses at one point. I couldn't find them. I saw them on him. It was a nightmare. It was awful. But that's not indicative of all Jordanian stuff because I did work with some other guys that were very serious and very good. But it's like everywhere. There's good and bad everywhere. All right. The Iraqi counter-terrorist force, obviously, Afghan militia, Afghan army. Yeah. Can you discuss more about your kit? Beginning with IDF, Irish Defence Forces, all the way to SF. That's a whole podcast by itself, and I'd love to, but that's a massive undertaking right there. But that's a really good, I'm going to take a note of that, because that's a really good one to do, because I have seen kit evolve over 30 freaking years. And yeah. Hey, Tim, what kind of matches you shooting over there, Tim? You're fast roping into a target, right? So what kind of sling? Look, VTAC sling is great because fast roping, you don't even have to sling the rifle on your back. It can go in your front and just cinch it down because you're grabbing the rope and there's a gap right there and you're sliding down the rope for fast roping. Gloves, if you have no time to change, wear two pairs of dexterity gloves, right? Obviously, it's best to have big, heavy gloves, especially if you're fast roping any kind of distance because you will burn the crap out of your hands. But if you don't have time to change, then two light pairs of gloves at least. And it depends, obviously, how far you're fast roping. You're probably not fast roping that far. So, but even if you've just one pair of light gloves, even a short fast rope will burn your hands. So either we used to run light gloves with heavy gloves over them and just get them off our hands when we hit the ground. If you're saying there's no time for that, then two pair of dexterity gloves and just suck it up and go to work. All right. Good luck. When I said, what am I going to talk about? People are like giving me suggestions, which is really cool. Anything Irish history related. Love listening to you and Oisin. If you haven't listened to previous episodes of me and Oisin, Oisin's a doctor, grew up in Ireland, born in the States, grew up in Ireland. Wicked, wicked, intelligent guy. Very well spoken, very articulate. Makes me sound like a freaking moron sometimes, but very much into Irish history. And we did some great podcasts. And all I say is, Oisin, let's do one. You pick the topic. And then he brings the topic and I just react to him. But all the knowledge is basically coming from him. I'm going to try, Oisin, if you're watching this, I'm going to try to get him on a Zoom call and do another one. Because they are very popular. People like him. And yeah, I'd like to do that again. You know, it's funny. When you grow up in a country, like I learned European history growing up, a lot of it, and it's so freaking extensive because it was like millennia, right? And it's all of Europe. And again, if you're a kid, I guess you don't have that much interest. And you know, people in America are like, oh my God, castles, because you don't see any castles in America, right? So, but castles everywhere in Ireland when I was growing up, we used to play on them as kids. And no interest, no friggin', now it fascinates me, right? History fascinates, but American history fascinates me too. The Civil War fascinates me, the Revolution fascinates me. I did, when I backpacked around Europe, I went to a lot of museums, I went to medieval torture museums in Austria that were just fucking insane. But, you know, history really does intrigue me now, maybe in my older part of my life, but I will try to get Oisin back. On Oisin took a job as a doctor that splits his time between the US and Ireland. So I'm not sure when he'll be back, but we'll try to do a podcast over Zoom before, and then we'll grab him when he gets back. Recommended any CCW pistols. Look, I'm not the guy that'd be like, oh, Glock, Sig, this, that, tight industry. You find a gun that you like, that you're comfortable with, that's the gun for you. If you can employ it quickly, be safe with it, and it fits your hand and you're comfortable, that's the gun for you. If I was you, I'd go to a range if you're looking for a CC and just shoot a couple of guns, rent them and shoot them and find the one that works for you. People talk about, and there's a question later on about the toxic gun industry and all that. It's horrible. I will talk about that. But people talk about, oh my God, this gun is garbage. And it's not garbage. It's there's a lot of good guns out there. And they'll take two guns that shoot the exact same round, and somehow one is garbage and the other one's like the greatest thing ever. And it's probably because they're tied to industry and they have to make it kind of mystique, because that's all they do. I'll talk about that later on. But find a gun that you like, whether it's a freaking revolver or a semi-auto. Get good with it. Get comfortable. And that's the gun for you. Don't go with what somebody else tells you, because it's an opinion. And it's an opinion maybe based on experience and maybe not. And we're all different. You find that when the gun industry, the tactical training industry, it's so toxic and they all talk shit about each other. And I don't want to do it. I don't want to teach pistol or carbine. I find it kind of boring. I think if you took pistol training with one or two companies and your fundamentals are good, you should be spending your money on ammo and a range and not having another guy to come in and teach you the same thing a different way. I remember people would talk about, if you don't do grip my way, you'll never hit anything, right? I remember when I was on the Q course and they were teaching us pistol, and the instructor, this is a Sims gun, obviously, and it's empty. The instructor got up in front of us and he was talking about grip and stance and all these things. And then he said, at the end of the day, check this out. And he turned the gun upside down and he fired. Boom, 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 boom. And he stacked like five rounds in the chest. And he's like, it's about trigger control. It's about recoil management to make you faster. And obviously there are established principles for holding a gun. You know, you get that dovetail up nice and high. You get that good grip, right? You get your left hand in the right position. You recoil management and all that. But at the end of the day, don't be spending thousands of dollars to get other people to teach you the same thing in a slightly different way. Just get ammo, get a bunch of buddies, download some drills off the internet and go shoot, and have a point to every drill. This drill is going to work on speed. This drill is going to work on accuracy. This drill is going to work on recoil management. This drill is going to work on switching gears from short distance to long distance. And that's what you need to spend your money. I don't know how I got on that, but that was nothing to do with concealed carry. Back in your army career, best courses done, most enjoyable, and courses you wish you did. I always say sniper school and Sephardic, right? Both 9-week schools, phenomenal. And Sephardic is that, I'm not even going to tell you what it means, because maybe I don't know, Special Forces Advanced Reconnaissance and Target Exploitation Techniques course, something like that. It's hostage rescue, CQB, shooting, breaching doors, blowing shit up, fast roping, taking out trains, buses, it's all this you join the army to do. And that was awesome because we had awesome instructors and it was a really, really, really good course. And I had a great group of guys in my class. Sniper school was great because I'd already had sniper training. I was a sniper in Ireland. I was in a SIF company and I already knew how to shoot a sniper rifle and run a ballistic calculator and all that kind of thing. They were the best two. Now, the ones I wish I did, like I did military free fall. I did free fall jump master. I did advanced tactical infiltration course. Never a free fall guy. I did it because I had to do it as part of my job, but wasn't something that I didn't go out on the weekend, even though I did when I was younger. I had a free fall license, but wasn't something I did. Never went to dive school. Never interested me. There are other courses that are offered, and I can't get into too much detail. I am going to probably next week, I am going to podcast the Command Sergeant Major in charge of SWIC, which is Special Warfare Center and School, all training in Special Forces. The Sergeant Major in charge of everything. And you're talking to Q Course, Selection, Free Fall School, Dive School, Sephardic, SODIC, or Sniper School, every freaking school in SWIC. He's a friend of mine. We were team sergeants together. He's an awesome guy. And if you send me questions, I will ask him. But people always ask me about selection and preparing for selection. And I'm outdated, right? I'm a freaking has-been. But he's the most current guy there. And he has a great attitude. He is positive. He's young. He's physically fit. He just wants to get good guys into the regiment, right? And he wants to nurture and train and mentor students. And that's what we need at that level, right? This old school attitude where we're trying to weed people out, that's not what it is anymore. And it's great to hear. I'm gonna podcast him probably next week. And if you have questions, that's the place to get it from, because this guy is at the cutting edge, at the tip of the spear at that, right? And he's a great guy. He'll answer all your questions. So there are courses within SF that take you on a more spy-ish route. That's not even a real word, but more of a low vis. Let's put it that way, right? I'm trying to pick my words carefully here, right? And it does kind of employ people who are good at chatting and good at talking to people and good at striking up conversations. And I never saw myself in that light. I just didn't think. So you end up going door kicker, sniper, hostage rescue, break stuff, right? Blow stuff up, and kind of a more low-vis source kind of route, right? I never saw myself as that guy, but now I think I probably could have done that. I'm very... A lot of times I didn't do things because I just didn't think I'd be good at it. But I think if I had went that route, I probably would have been good at it. But it's hard to do both, right? You got to pick one or the other lane. I don't know if that makes any sense or not. But I'm not saying I wish I'd gone through those courses, because I did go to some of them. But the best courses I did were sniper school and Subfortic hostage rescue, CQP. That was, those were freaking, they're all-time great courses. What's the most, this is a good question, what's the most difficult adaptation from Irish Army to US Army? Keep up the good work. Thank you so much. Believe it or not, marching. Marching was hard to relearn because the Irish Army took their marching from the British Army. And your arm, when you swing your arms, you swing it up to the shoulder of the man in front of you. And when you like stomp your leg, you bring your thigh up parallel to the marching surface and you slap it in. And when I started marching in the American Army, it's very relaxed marching, right? You just kind of walk and swing your arms a little bit. I was swinging them up, and I remember the drill sergeant fucking yelling at me. He was like, "What the fuck are you doing?" And it was hard to break that. It was actually, CQB is hard to relearn too. If you learn CQB a certain way, it's very hard to, I think because it becomes such a natural instinct, it's very hard to relearn it a different way. But marching was a nightmare because I couldn't fucking keep those arms down, man. I kept wanting to rise up to the shoulder of the man in front of you. And by the time I got in the American Army basic training, I'd been out of the Irish Army for a couple of years, but it still was so ingrained in my brain, it was hard to relearn. And I can't remember. This big drill sergeant said something really funny to me, and I can't remember what it was. But that was a hard one. Hardest training experience in SF. ARW Green Beret, right? So I will tell you now, and it's easy for me to say this because it's all over for me. Nothing in the Army is as hard as people make it out to be. Because if I embellish my accomplishment, you know, I can beat my chest and go, oh, it's not for everybody, right? Yes, there are hard times, there were hard training. But if your mindset is right, you just suck it up and move on. SUT, the small unit tactics portion, like selection for SF, selection for the Army Ranger Wing was pretty tough, pretty physical. A lot of people got hurt, but came through the other end, right? So then the Q course, the training course for Ranger Wing was very easy. Not easy, but it was very physical and all that kind of thing. There was no yelling and screaming. It was teaching, right? The way it should be. When I got into the American Army, soft selection I thought was great because, again, I was like 35. And it was a lot of just, you're the guy, right? Your rucksack, your weight, and go. Land navigation, don't be last, don't be late, don't be light. Rucksack, easy, right? Got through selection. The Q course was challenging because, and I've said this before, it was 2002, and they pulled a lot of instructors out and replaced them with National Guard guys who didn't know what they were doing, and they smoked the shit out of us and push-ups and set up, because that's all they knew how to do, and it was horrible. But again, it was not horrible physically because I was in great shape. It was horrible mentally because I just wanted to learn, and I didn't need to learn how to do flutter kicks on a hill, right? So that was frustrating. It wasn't hard. It was frustrating. The Special Forces Weapons Sergeant course, I'm not great at math. And people think snipers are great at math. I'm fucking terrible at math. Plotting with an old school plotting board for mortar stuff, for FDC, that was hard for me. That math... So that was the only part. Then SEER school. Nowadays, people have a lot more information about what's happening in SEER school. I really didn't know anything when I went to SEER school. I heard they slap you, but I don't really believe it. And the first time they pulled that hood off and they fucking slapped the shit out of me, that shit hurt. I saw sparks. I was like, oh my God, that shit hurt. And I fought in the ring and I did martial arts growing up and all that. And I've been in a lot of fights. That shit shocked me, right? But that SEER school was tough in that realm, right? Because I just wasn't mentally ready for it. But, you know, the longer you're there, the more you kind of get a hold of it. And then after that, you know, things are physically tough and a little mentally tough, but nothing is that hard. So if you want to talk about the hardest training experience, probably SEER school, just because it sucked. and you're in prison for a couple of days, and you're like, when is this going to end? And that was probably the hardest. But the rest, man, if you want to go, you can do it. It's not as hard as people make it out to be. 18 X-ray conditional contract requiring 1 year in the regular army infantry prior to SFES. I didn't know about this, and I will ask the command sergeant major Charles Swick about this, but it sounds like when you send, when you sign up for 18 X-ray now, maybe you have to do a year in the regular army. A year in the regular army do you really good. One of the big failings of the 18 X-ray course is that you come in, you do basic training, advanced infantry training at Fort Benning, you go to airborne school, and then you come to Fort Bragg, and you do a special forces selection preparation course where they, you know, PT the crap out of you and teach you the land nav, and then you do selection. And if you pass, then you go to an NCO school, which I used to run, and then you go to Q course. And those younger 18 X-rays have never been in the regular army. It's actually good for you, especially if you're young, to spend a year in the regular army. It'll make you appreciate SF more. You'll learn a lot, as long as you go to a decent infantry unit. You'll learn a lot there. And you're not, it's not like you're killing a year that you don't have. I was 35 when I went to selection. You have the time, it would be good for you to go there. I would highly advise if you go to the infantry for a year, go to Ranger, try to go to Ranger school if you can. Try to get as many school, as much experience as you can before you, and you will be a better Green Beret for it. I'm telling you that right now. So I think if that's the new policy, which I don't know that it is, then I think it's probably a good thing. When a new guy comes to a team, how long does it take to tell if he's a good operator? That's a weird one for me, because again, 30 freaking five going to Q course, very, very experienced, got to the team, thought that everybody probably knew more than me, but quickly found that they didn't. I think there's an art to blending. I didn't blend that well on my first team. They weren't really my type of guy, right? I didn't really bond with them, and I was on that team for like 2 years, and then I went over to B23, and those guys were all about fighting and killing, and very, really cool team, and guys are friends of mine to this day. So even if you don't bond with a team as a new guy, it just might be not a compatible match, right? And that happens. And the team, the Special Forces team, is generally, the personality of that team is generally driven by the team sergeant or the most influential member on that team. It's usually the team sergeant, but it might not be. It might be a senior medic or engineer, and he's the guy who sets the precedence on that team. But teams do take a personality, like they really do. And if you don't fit, then you don't fit, and it's best to move on. For me, I was very, very lucky when I was a team sergeant, because all the guys, because I was in a SIF company, all the guys on my team were freaking E7 rock stars. It was fucking super easy. I wasn't getting any new guys off the Q course because they couldn't get there. They didn't have all these schools and experience. So I was very, very lucky. But I've talked to other guys, friends of mine, who were team sergeants and had young E5s and all that. And you really do got to wrangle and micromanage those guys, because they're the only experience they have in the Army is training in the Q course, right? So they really don't know how to conduct themselves. Now, you'll get guys who are 25, 30, and they've asked me about going to selection and all that, and that's not too old. You will be more respected coming in because you're older and you're more mature, whether you know it or not. Young men tend to be quite immature. I was immature as hell till I was like 25, and maybe I still am. But I was lucky. There was one guy who didn't bond to my team, and I ended up moving him. But it wasn't that he was bad at his job, he just wasn't a good fit. What I hated most about what's super toxic on a small team is bitching and complaining. It's like a virus, man. It will drag the whole team down. You got a complaint, bring it to me. I'm the boss. I might listen to you or I might not. But if you're behind closed doors bitching and complaining all the time, it destroys teams. And if you have a good team, oh, I did get rid of another guy, but the guys will police that up. The guys on your team will police that up and shut it down. My favorite countries to live in, worst countries to avoid. I haven't lived in, I've been deployed, but obviously, you know, the United States is my favorite country to live in, but I would like to live in Australia, I think, although there's so much shit down there that can kill you, man, bugs and snakes and stuff, but I think New Zealand would be a cool place to live in, but again, never been. The worst countries to live in, I guess Somalia would be up there with that one. Jordan, like driving in Oman, Jordan was insane. Worst freaking drivers I've ever seen. And then, you know, some of those Middle Eastern countries are so freaking hot. They're brutal. I think if I wasn't living in the States, I'd like to live in Australia or New Zealand. But again, never been there. possible films. Wind That Shakes the Barley, Black 47, 71, etc. Could be super fun. Oh, to talk about those. Okay, Wind That Shakes the Barley is about the IRA in the 20s. Actually, Cillian Murphy's in it. Actually, a pretty good movie. Black 47 is a really good movie. I really like that movie. And that's kind of the anti-hero, right? He was working for the British Army in Afghanistan, I think, and he came back and he saw that, you know, the famine was going on, he saw what was going on, he just started killing people. I like that anti-hero revenge thing. And 71 is about a British soldier who gets separated from his unit in Belfast in 1971. Pretty good movie too. I could talk about those. And somebody said, you and Oisin should sit down and go through movies. I just don't think people want to. Yeah, there is. Would you and Oisin consider viewing of Irish movies with your own color commentary? I don't know if people want to listen to us running our mouths while the movie's going on. Are you guys traveling to teach more and or staying in North Carolina? I'm okay with traveling, right? I'm trying to expand. I just don't want to get on a plane, and I don't want to. I was on a plane. Where was I coming back from recently? Oh, it was when I was out with the Marine Corps in Utah, and a freaking plane got delayed, and then got that the airport was closed in Denver because of snow, and it got rerouted to some piddly ass little airport. And I'm just like, God, I hate flying because of that. I am going next month to Tennessee to teach a long gun class. That means I can load up my Sprinter van with all my gear, and I can throw Vinny in there. Me and my wife could drive out there, right? Do the thing, maybe see some sights because Tennessee's got some awesome Civil War stuff, and I come back. That's easy. My goal right now is to have a stress-free life, right? Now, if it's a 12-hour drive, I'm okay with that. I just got to find ranges that are willing to host me, and I will run long gun there. Now, you know, when I started this whole thing, I was like, I'll go where the market brings me. But long gun is actually, precision rifle is where the market is, right? Because there's so few people who can do it, and there's even less people who can teach it. So that's kind of, and I enjoy teaching it, and I enjoy seeing students freaking rise that skill level quickly. So I'm okay driving even up to 12 hours to teach a class at a range, but I'm having trouble finding ranges that'll host me. So if you know of a range that even I need a classroom for day one, and I need at least 800 meters, really. Overhead cover would be appreciated, especially down the south. And I will come in there and teach a class as long as I have enough leeway to sell it, and as long as they don't charge me too much money. I'm okay coming in there, and they host it, and I run a class there. That's what I'm doing in Tennessee. I have another one in North Carolina in August, which I think there's some slots left for. And then I'm looking for spots after that, because I don't want to run one every month in North Carolina. You run out of customers. I like to bounce around and do one or two a month because I enjoy it. Which injuries part of your body suffered most from all your years of training? My brain. Now, my shoulders got torn. Both my rotator cuffs are torn. And I'm terrible because I just don't go to the doctor. I take painkillers. I remember, and like I tore my left one on a free fall jump, and then I tore my right one. I can't remember how I tore it, but if you're a medical person, my supraspinatus in my left arm is 90% torn. And I just stopped doing the things that make it hurt. But I remember going to the Advanced Tactical Infiltration course, which was Jumpmaster School in Yuma for 3 weeks, and then this course for 3 weeks, and it was advanced stuff. And you know, you jump. Sometimes it's hey ho, high altitude, high opening, jump, pull the chute right away and fly, and that was okay. It was when you're in free fall for a long time, and free fall is only like it's not that long, but with the wind tunnel, we went to the wind tunnel. And when I'm in the wind tunnel in that, my arm, in that position, I can't do it. And I went to the instructor, I was like, dude, I can't do this. My shoulder's jacked up. And it wasn't a requirement for graduation, so they let me sit out. But my shoulders, my rotator cuffs are bad. Like, and I need surgery in both of them. But the thought of having my arm in a cast for months, and it's stupid, I know. I should just suck it up, but I just try not to lift anything over my head. It's so bad. But I tell you, take care of yourself. If you're starting your military career and something happens, get freaking surgery. And it was never a good time because we were fighting two wars. And it just, it's stupid. I should have took better care of myself. How do you build up people with less confidence? Does that change how you teach? That's a great question. I do. So when I teach, I try to, when I teach long range shooting, again, people think it's witchcraft, right? But it's actually just math. And I talk about the things that So they understand what it is, but I don't go down. Like Coriolis is the rotation of the air, and it sounds really cool. If you're shooting inside 1,000, you don't need to worry about it. You'll miss 10 times for wind before you miss once for Coriolis, right? So I try to build people up and explain in very easy terms, right? I use a simulator, and I use a lot of training aids when I teach. And then when I shoot, I start guys up fairly close, get a good solid zero, make sure the position is perfect. And then when we shoot, we try to walk it out further and help them with wind, right? And a huge piece of long range shooting and probably a lot of training is confidence, right? If you put people on longer targets too quickly and they start missing, they start second guessing their data, they start second guessing their gun and their scope and their ability and their spotter and all those things, right? But if you walk them out there slowly, and the one we did in North Carolina is great because it was all in the same direction of fire. It was fairly easy to call wind and the targets were fairly big. At the end of that class on Sunday, I always do this. I had six teams and then I start at 200, right? I don't want to start too far out because I don't want guys missing. So I start at 200 and I say, okay, team one, send it. You have 10 seconds to send a shot, 10 seconds for a second shot correction. If you hit the first one, you don't have to shoot the second time. And then we move on, team two, team three, team four, team five, team six, right? And if you shoot and miss and you have 10 seconds for a second shot, and if you miss the second shot, then you lock and clear your gun and you did a walk of shame, step off the line, right? We walked it out. We started 2, 3, 4. I think we were 800 and everybody was still hitting. And two guys were shooting 5.56 guns. We went to 900 and the winds were squirrely and a couple of guys missed, but the guys with the 5.56 smacked that thing. And a couple of guys with 308s went out to 1,000 and the 5.56 guys missed, or it's too hard to see their impact, right? It's hard to see impact with a 5.56 at that range. And the guys with the 308 hit, and the guys with the 308 brand new shooters, right? Their confidence level has skyrocketed at that point. So I think you make training, I think too many people make training too difficult and too unattainable. You're not going to combat with these people, man. They need to walk away with a sense that they learned something and that they walked away with capability, because money's scarce and you want them to feel like it's money well spent. So I try to build them up slowly and I try to make training very relaxed. I don't, because it creates a better learning environment. People are more relaxed, it's more, the atmosphere's better and they just learn better. And I throw in some stories and jokes and all that kind of thing. You know, we take guns seriously, obviously, we take safety seriously, but we can have a good time. That's the point, okay? That's a great question. The most funny experience you ever had in combat, no holds barred. No holds barred is a dangerous word. I'll have to get back to that one. I think a lot of them I already talked about. But let me get back to that one. Have you ever worked with any Aussies? The only time I worked with the Australians was in Somalia when I was a contractor. And the Australians were there. And the Australian military. And I tell you, man, I grew up in Ireland and we were hard drinkers. But them fucking Aussies, them boys could and gals could drink some beer. Not messing around. We flew in a helicopter one time. We were looking at Kismayo, which is in the southern part of Somalia. And we flew in a Huey. Me and people that worked in our office and an Australian logistics officer and two Australian SAS guys, and we flew all the way from Mogadishu all the way down to Kismayo because we were looking at the port in Kismayo as an alternative if pull people out if Mogadishu got too hot. And I hung around with those guys, man, really good guys and you know, really solid. And you'll see a lot of soft guys around the world. At least this has been my experience. And they're very similar guys. They're just the same guy with a different accent and a weird accent if it's Australia. I'm just messing with you. I'm not one to talk. Any plans to shoot competitively PRS NRL Hunter? I shot competitively for years. I shot matches all over the place. I shot military matches. I don't have time, number one. I don't have the gear. If I wanted to compete, I'd want to compete at a high level and I'd want to reload my own ammo and put a lot of money into it. And I think that part of my life is over and I get a lot of fulfillment from teaching others. I was on the range yesterday with Montana Grit, who Bree has a nonprofit and takes people hunting and all that. And she's taking Kirsten hunting. So we went out there yesterday and Sig gave Kirsten some gear. They gave her a Sig Cross 308 with this scope, with the BDX that you know, you and they give her a rangefinder and stay binos. So you laze the target with your Sig Kilo 5K and it drops a dot in your optic to where you hold. to compensate for gravity, right? And so we went out there yesterday, we zeroed, we chronographed the gun, we built it in the ballistic calculator, and then I gave her max point blank, which is a number you get off the cash roll you can dial, and it'll tell you, and we were shooting 12-inch targets, so you can pick the targets, and you go max point blank, and it gave her like 2.5 minutes of angle, and then you can hit every target out to 350 yards, right? Not even knowing the range. So we dialed max point blank, and I'm like, shoot all those targets. And she was sitting going, whack, 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 whack. And to see that confidence level grow with a very minimal training, that's kind of what fulfills me now. I like to teach. I think passing that on to people, and it is very fulfilling to me. Running matches, especially with my injuries, getting in and out of positions and all that, that shit's over for me. Did it for a while. Not going to do it anymore. I mean, some of those matches, those NRL Hunter matches and stuff, phenomenal matches. Just not for me. Why hasn't 6.5 been more widely adopted replacement for the 308? I don't know if you're talking in the military or generally. 308's a great round. 6.5 is better ballistically. Now, if you want to argue with me, great. Your opinion is an opinion. My opinion is based on years of testing in a controlled environment by SOCOM and US military and the Marine Corps and everybody else, right? Now, if you have not outshot your 308, then it's fine. For what you do, it's fine. I can put a 308 on, a fairly cheap 308. I got good ammo, and I can throw good optic on it and get some ballistics, and I can rock targets out to 1,000 all day long. It's available. It's a decent price, right? But if in a military aspect, or if you're competing at a higher level, you're talking about 6.5, higher ballistic coefficient, kind of similar ballistic coefficient to my 300 Win Mag, but in a gas gun, right? You're talking at 140 grand, you know, Berger hybrid, let's say, high BC bullet, high muzzle velocity, lower recoil. There's just so many advantages to it. Now, if you have not outshot your 308, then it's fine for what you do. You don't need to go chasing these bullets to get these little bits of improvement, right? The reason we kept 308 in the ASR, the Advanced Sniper Rifle, for SOCOM in the Army is a couple of reasons. We have millions of rounds in inventory. That was one. Number two, a lot of the ranges won't allow you to shoot 300 Norma because it breaks what's called the surface danger zone. So you can put a 308 barrel on there, do a lot of your training, and then move and do some of your training with the 300 Norma. It's just a math problem. It's just a different wind call, really, because your Kestrel gives you all the data, right? And the last reason is, if I put a 300 Norma on guns in Fort Bragg and Fort Benning, a lot of these places, guys are not making a wind call. They're holding left edge into the wind, right edge into the wind, and just crushing shit. And you don't really learn to call wind. With the 308, you really do need to make a good wind call. And that's why. Those are the reasons. Great round for training. Shoot it on any range. Millions of rounds of in the inventory. Those are the reasons we kept it in there. I love 308. I have probably four long-range 308 guns in there. And I love it. But if I was competing, I'd be running something like a 6.5 Creedmoor or 7mm, something like that. It hasn't been adopted in the Army because the Army, SOCOM, and it was me and Terry Gower that kind of started that program, but SOCOM is now, I think the uppers are even issued, the ammo's delayed for some reason, but we're going to 6.5 Creedmoor for the sniper support weapon, right, and got away from 308. The Army has not gone that route and may never go that route, and maybe they don't need to. Maybe it's good enough for what they do. But to me, even an incremental improvement in a gunfight is worth it, right? But I see more and more in the civilian world, people who come to my courses, I see more and more 6.5 Creedmoors. I see them a lot. Here's a great one here. Explain steep angle, shot corrections, truing a rifle, gun number, gas versus bolt gun. Good Lord, dude. That's a whole class. I promised you guys a private class on people who subscribe to my website, and I have not forgotten. I always deliver. I don't know, maybe that's a good one to do a private class on. I'll explain steep angle quickly, right? Steep angle is the most exaggerated thing ever. Out to 600, a realistic, like, people are like 45 and 60 degree angle. 60 degree angle is tied up at ropes and leaning over the side of a mountain, right? And the top of a building is not high angle. You need mountains for high angle, right? Because you need the distance and the angle, right? Now, the basic premise is, if I'm on a mountain and I'm shooting down angle or up angle, all my data is based off a flat plane, right? So all my data, if I'm shooting 800 meters and I'm holding 6 mils, that's because I have 6 mils of drop, 6 mils of gravity, right? But if I'm shooting at an angle, I no longer, that distance is 800, but with the rangefinder. But gravity's not pushing this way. It's pushing straight down. So there's less gravity distance. It's actually from the base of the mountain out, right? So you may be, you know, you're shooting, let's say you're shooting 800 and you're holding 6 mils normally. Now you may hold 5.7 or something like that. If you hold his belt buckle, you'll probably hit him, right? Now, at longer distances and steeper angles, it makes a huge difference. But people just exaggerate how much difference it makes. And you climb to the top of your roof in your house at 2 stories and you want to shoot high angle, it's not high angle. And people say, well, what if you're shooting straight down? That's a bore height issue, right? So it's very, very misunderstood, but people don't understand it and it's so exaggerated. Most of the time, out to 600, you freaking hold belt buckle and you'll probably hit him. The bullets always go high because you're giving it more elevation than you need because it's not flying over this much distance of gravity. It's flying over this much distance of gravity. I need PowerPoint to explain that a little better. Truing the rifle is getting your muzzle velocity without a chronograph. Again, that's a class. Gun number is in the Kestrel. Gas gun versus bolt gun. Pros and cons to everything, brother. Pros and cons to everything. Big, heavy bullets are better shot through a bolt gun. 300 mm mag and above. 6.5 grade gas gun, good gas gun. And it used to be gas guns could not shoot like bolt guns, but that's kind of gone now. But you have to put some money into it. Land navigation again, thinking about it. What's your thoughts on bullpup sniper rifles like Desert Tech? So again, love the bullpup concept. Haven't found a gun. I have a Tavor there, which I did a video on, but we haven't edited it yet. And I will. Love the concept because you get a long barrel and a short package. The Desert Tech, they did not compete for the advanced sniper rifle contract. They were part of the process. We talked to them. It was, you know, it could have been a bullpup. The big problem with the Desert Tech is, unless they've changed it since the last one I saw, when you take a shot, long range shooting is all about consistency. When you take a shot, when you rack that bolt, you have to take your cheek off the cheek piece to rack the bolt. That's a flaw. Because I need to be able to rack that bolt and keep my eye on the target. So I go bang. Let's say I'm shooting 900. I go bang. While the bullet's in flight, I'm racking that bolt and I'm watching the impact and I'm ready for a second shot correction. If I have to take my cheek out, I'm building inconsistency, I'm losing the target. That was a flaw. It could be fixed, but they haven't fixed it as far as I understand. I like the concept. Haven't found a bolt gun, a long range gun in bullpup that I like. I just haven't. Now I have with a carbine. Now people will say, oh, the Tavor is a 2 minute of angle gun. What do you want from your carbine, right? A 2 minute of angle gun shoots a 10 inch group at 500 meters. That's actually pretty good. What do you need? It's not a sniper rifle, right? Now I have carbines in there that'll shoot a minute of angle and sub minute of angle, but they're not short like that thing, right? 16 inch gun that's smaller than a 10 inch M4, and there's no NFA stamp in most places. I think New Jersey has an overall length requirement, but that's New Jersey. But I can get this, I can have this, and it is shorter than a 10 inch M4. And I apologize if you're on audio now on podcast and you can't see it. I have a 1-6 on this, pretty good system, short, but I don't need any NFA documentation on it. 16 inch barrel. Pretty damn good, right? I like it. It's comfortable to shoot. All right, what's something non-tactical, non-shooting you like to do? Sleep. I mean, we go hiking a lot and we go to historical sites, stuff like that. What else do we do? Have you ever considered taking the long walk? I talked about this. I don't mind. The long walk is Delta Force selection. Now, Delta Force is the most professional an efficient hostage rescue unit in the world. Those guys are phenomenal. And I know a lot of them personally. And I used to train them when I worked at sniper school. They used to say, sniper school for special operations for the Army trains Green Berets, Rangers, and Delta Force. And I think it's changed now. But great unit, very professional. So I kind of missed my window. I came in the Army at 29, right? Great. I think men and women are in their prime in the 30s physically. When I went to, I could not go to selection because I wasn't a U.S. citizen. I had a green card. And it took me 6 years. It's different now, but it took me 6 years to get a U.S. citizenship. And when I got it, I went to selection, SF selection right away. I didn't even consider Delta because I didn't know anything about it. then I get in and I bounced around. We were fighting wars and all that kind of thing. And then when I was at sniper school as an instructor, we had a couple of, actually as a student, when I was there as a student, we had a couple of Delta guys, and they both came to me and they're like, dude, you need to come over to us. And at the time I was probably 40 and I was like, dude, I'm too old. And they're like, no, we got guys your age. And I'm like, yeah, but they're not starting out. And if I was honest with myself, I think there was some fear of failure there on my part, right? And it's knowing somewhat what the selection course is about, I probably would have been able to do it. But I think I was just, and fear of failure is a horrible reason not to do something. So I never went. And it's one of the regrets I have. But it is what it is. I don't look back. But I never went, yeah. Your time at SWIC, you saw changes in the guys coming through over the years. I'm not the guy who's like, oh, it was so much harder in my day, right? And I'm really looking forward to talking to the Command Sergeant Major at SWIC to see what his thoughts are. I think the kids coming through now are probably smarter than we were. I don't know if they're as tough, but they're probably smarter. And they're going there for the right reasons. Not that we didn't. When I went, there was, you know, the Afghanistan was already going on. But look, there's good and bad everywhere. And there's a selection process that's not perfect. The Q course is not perfect, but we get pretty damn good people, right? Like I said on my last podcast, I was out there training with the Marine Corps, MARSOC, Marine Special Operations. Very impressed with those guys. Super professional, fit, motivated, just great dudes. And it put, you know, you get so bogged down in all this crap that you see on social media about freaking all this, you know, woke crap and all that. It just reaffirms how phenomenal young people in America can be. And it kind of reassures you that we're not going to go to hell in a handbasket in the next freaking year or two. Buy night vision gear or wait. I don't have night vision gear. I can't afford it. I'm not sure what you would need. If you really want something night vision, you can get thermal sights that are uncooled. They're okay at distance. And people use them for hunting a lot, and they're not nearly as expensive as actual, you know, PBS 14s or 31s. Maybe something for guys with not so fancy bolt guns and how to spruce them up. That's a great one. So I'm going to do that. There's a store here in North Carolina that in Eastwood called Eastwood Outfitters. And I went over there and it's all precision rifle stuff and precision rifle adapters and rails and bipods and high-end guns and you know, not so high-end guns. And I talked to those guys. So I'm going to go over there and do a YouTube video and I'm going to have them lay out a bunch of stuff and go, okay, I'm on a budget. What do I need to buy and what would you recommend, right? This bipod, this gun, this caliber, this optic, and then, you know, that's the budget option, and then here's the high-end option. And I'm going to do that probably week after next, and I'll go over there and walk through all that crap. People want me to do stuff like that, but I don't have the gear for it. I want to show you the gear and the pros and cons and all that. So there are attachments that you can do to your long-range rifle that can help out. If you don't have a level on there, you're kidding yourself. If you don't have one of these things, this Kestrel, you're kidding yourself. But I'm going to go over and get that content done. It's funny, somebody on YouTube, and I appreciate the comments, was like, Kevin, you can have 1 million followers if you just do more content. There's no money in content, at least not for me. It's maybe $50 a month from YouTube. It wouldn't pay for the gas I would pay to go somewhere, right? And I have no income now. I have a little bit of income from courses, but from content, it's nothing. So, and content takes time, and it takes time to edit. And the other thing, I just don't want to throw out garbage just for the sake of throwing out garbage. But I appreciate the comment. And there's a couple of people who actually donate it to the podcast. You can go on my podcast and you can make a donation if you want to support. And there's a couple of people who did that, and I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. That is so generous. Would you be interested in doing a podcast with Chris Craighead, Chris Ryan, or Rusty Furman? I think they're all SAS guys. Maybe Chris Ryan, because I've seen him on stuff and he seems like a fairly solid guy. But I don't know. I try not to beat that military soft veteran drum too hard. I think it's overdone. My goal for podcasts is just interesting people. I talked to a buddy of mine. He's a retired soft guy. And I was talking to him about something else the other day. And we started talking about fish. And he fishes off the coast of North Carolina. And he just started, he has a boat. He's out like 60, 70, 80, 100 miles. And you know about sharks and all that. And he was saying, you know, you're reeling in a big fish. And just as you get it to the top of the water, the shark is waiting underneath the boat. And it comes up and just snatches it. And it's pretty common. They call it paying the tax man. You got to pay the tax man, you know, to use his ocean. And I just, people like that who are just interesting to talk about. You know, people ask me to go on their podcast all the time, and I just don't want, I don't want to be overexposed, and I don't want people to be like, oh, this fecker again, I want to listen to this guy, right? LPVO, low power variable optic, or higher magnification versus magnifier and on a 14.5 rival. Look, if you have a 14.5, I think you should have magnification. I think you should have a 1 to 6 minimum and a 45 degree offset. That's my opinion. I think you're not getting full capability out of that thing if you just put a, and I don't like magnifiers. I never have. I never ran them. I just don't like having to flip something up, you know. Who's your biggest supporter? My wife, hands down. Why did you leave Philcraft? Okay, there's another one. How does your optic height affect your zero you should have in your AR? If you don't, so if you don't have one of these, you really need one. I guess you could use some of those apps on your phone. But when I go in, that Tavor, I zeroed that the other day, right? And I don't want to get too technical on this, but I zeroed, it's got a BDC reticle, a ballistic drop compensated reticle for 55 grand. And it's got crosshairs, and then the first line for range is 300, and then 400, 500, 600. So what I do, this is how I zero that, right? And it's just understanding ballistics. I zero that thing, and I chrono it. I chrono it first, because I want the muzzle velocity. And then I build a custom drag model, and then I get into the gun, and I change my zero. I'll start at 25, and I'll drop it down to 24, and 23, and 22, and I'll go up and down, and then I'll go to the range card, until there's no hold at 300, which means the near zero is 19, let's say, and it's climbing up and it's breaking the line of sight of the optic and it's hitting a distance at 300. But I'm using the 300 line, I'm not using crosshairs, right? So now I'm zeroing at 19 meters or whatever it tells me to zero at, and I'm zeroed perfectly at 300, because if I have error, I'm better off to have the error close than at distance, right? So if I zero at 100 and it's perfect, it'd probably be off at 2 and 3 and 4. I need a minute of angle off at 4 is 4 inches. A minute of angle off at 1 is 1 inch. I want my error to be closer, right? So I'll zero at the 300 meter line at a nearer zero. I don't know if this makes any sense to people, but your bore height, your optic height affects your max point blank. It affects, you know, shooting over obstacles and stuff like that. But if you have all that information in here, it'll tell you where to zero and where your alternate zero is. And it's freaking, it once you understand that, it's a game changer. But I want my error to be close. So if I'm an inch, if I have to hold an inch or two low at 100, I can remember that pretty easily. But holding off at 3 and 4 is much harder. So I want 3 and 4 to be perfect. And if there's a little error, I want it to be closer. I don't know if that made any sense. What do you do when you love your highly experienced firearms trainer but don't seem to be improving? If people train, like if cops train at me and they train at me this year, I'll tell them go somewhere else next year, because you have to. And I heard Brian Morgan say that if you have to experience different instructors, and there's good instructors and bad instructors, we're all tied to this experience that we have, and we might be missing something, and it's good to go talk to other people, in my opinion. How do you know what's the right long range setup for you? A lot of times people have great setups, but they're not. I'll have people come to my class and they'll say I've been shooting for 20 years. I'm doing a lot of this, right? And then when they get behind the optic, when they get behind the gun, they'll get it close and then they'll strain their head to take out all the shadow, right? I don't do it that way. I put you in a super comfortable position where you could take a nap, and then you'll get these people who've been shooting for years, and I'll put them in a super comfortable position. I'll cover the optic, and when they come up in that comfortable position, they can't even see through the scope. And then you move the scope, the cheek piece, the length of pole to suit your position. You don't move your position to shoot to suit the scope, right? You should be in a position where you can, it's repeatable and it's super comfortable and there's no strain on you at all, right? When you get behind that thing, you should be so comfortable that every time you come up, it's perfectly lined up. And that, now depending, again, it depends on what you're shooting. If you're shooting 800 and in, man, you could rock that shit with a 308 gas gun, right? Now, if you're shooting 1,500 meters, you're going to need a bigger caliber, more magnification, and a little bit of knowledge, a lot of knowledge on wind and ballistic calculator, all that kind of stuff, right? So it depends what you're shooting, and there's just so many variables out there. There is ways to get into this long-range stuff fairly cheaply, right? Not cheaply, that's the wrong answer. Decent gun, decent optic, and then just build your gear over time. And that's what I'm going to do that content on at that place. There, you introduce the toxicity among veteran platforms who have training companies. This is a great one, man. It is horrible. And I don't get involved, but it is horrible. If I did a video right now and I said, hey, this is how you grip a pistol, I would have all those guys attacking me viciously. And they're insecure because they don't have a lot of knowledge. And that's why I do long gun, because so few people know it and very few people can teach it. That's why I do the driving stuff out there, and I try to do stuff that nobody else does. But if there's 20 tactical veteran companies and they're all looking for the same customer, pistol and carbine, right? The only way they can elevate themselves is drag everybody else down. And it's fucking sad. It really is, because they're all fighting for that customer. I don't get involved. If I was teaching pistol, if I was teaching carbine, or if I had videos, when you put a video of CQB up, you have everybody coming out of the woodwork. Oh, what if this, and what if that, and what if your car was your toothbrush and your hairbrush was, it's insane, right? But because the long gun thing is so niche, people just don't know. Now, people have opinions, and that's fine, but all these tactical companies who attack each other viciously, it's really sad. And all they're trying to do is elevate themselves by pulling everybody else down. And I'll just block your ass. You want to run your mouth to me? I make no apology. You want to run your mouth to me and be disrespectful because you're a tough guy behind your computer? I just block you. I don't even answer you. I don't even finish reading your comment. I just block you because I'm not going to deal with it, because that's the little entitled bitch society that we've built now, that I feel like I should be able to talk shit to you anonymously while watching your free content that you did on your own time with no money, right? For free. It's insane. So you want to run your mouth to me? You want to disagree with me? Great. You want to run your mouth to me? I'll just block you. This is a weird one. How do you deal with nightmares the day after? I feel emotionally exhausted. I've never had nightmares, man. I don't know what you're talking about. The day after, maybe some, a gunfight or something. I've no regrets about anything I ever did, and I don't get nightmares. Some of these I will go back and do more content on. Some I skipped over. Some are very repetitive. All right, so coming up, I've been doing Zoom classes. If you want to get into long gun and you're not around here, even if you are around here, take a look at Zoom, right? I can teach you over Zoom. I have all kinds of programs I can run. I can run you through. And everybody who've done it so far have been super happy with it. Some guys have done it and then came down and did in-person training. I have private training coming up here next weekend. That's a good option, right? I do in-person private training also. And then I have courses, right? So that one I did in North Carolina sold out. The one in Tennessee coming up is sold out. The one, I think there's still slots on the 26th and 27th of August. I think there's still slots there. The driving course, which I cut to the bone, defensive driving, and didn't make screw all money on it, I thought would sell like hotcakes, and it didn't. I'm not sure if I'm not selling it right. It is defensive driving. It is also scenario training and the law and all that. There's still one slot available. So I was going to run another one in August, but I don't think I will now. So if you want to go, you might want to jump in that last slot. There's a lot of overhead, so it's kind of risky to run a course that may not sell, because I don't like canceling courses. Then I am looking for other places to go for training and stuff like that. Kirsten has been doing some private training too. She's been training, and she's a great instructor, and she's got a lot of experience. So if you are listening to this and you or your wife want to get some private training from somebody who actually is going to teach you, that's a good option too. Okay. All right, guys, that's it for this one. I don't even know how long that was, but hope you got something out of it. Please stay engaged. I'm trying to do more content. It's freaking time and consuming, and plenty of training, plenty of options. And oh, merch, hat, t-shirt, stickers. That's it. If you want to go, you want to support us, go ahead and go online there and buy some merch. Not a lot of money in merch. It's more of a marketing thing, but I appreciate it. And then you can donate to the podcast if you want, and subscribe to the channel. And I am going to make a free video for you guys probably this week. And yeah, more to come. Okay, until next time. Thank you. Bye.